All right, welcome back, folks, to episode 2 of the Surrender Birdies podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon, and I'm joined by co-host Josh Hafkin. Josh, how's it going, man?
Hey, Alex. I am doing great, man. Excited to be here and excited to talk golf again with you, man.
Love it. Well, I think we've got a few things to chat about. One of the overarching themes I think we're going to get to, I'm going to talk about a couple things first. But I think this episode is going to be a lot about night golf. Last night, we're recording this on a Tuesday, and last night was the match down at the park at West Palm. But I'm going to hit pause on that, but I think we're going to talk about a lot of night golf today. One of the reasons I want to pause is just want to make sure for folks that are listening to this, I think most people that have found Surrender Birdies probably are well familiar with Beltway Golfer, maybe already listening to Beltway Golfer, but want to plug episode 79 that just came out this week with the superintendent up at PBDI Golf Club, just outside of Frederick, Maryland, Chris Navin. Had an awesome day a week or two ago with him, spent the 4 hours with him, recorded a podcast in the basement of the PBDI clubhouse, which I'd never been down there. If you do listen to the podcast, the audio is a little bit funky because the room was so echoey because we were the only two, there's nothing else down there, but had a great conversation. He just came off winning, gosh, I'm going to forget the name of the award, but the Herb Graffis Business Person of the Year award by Golfdom Magazine, which is the magazine for superintendents. Was just honored with that award out at the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America trade show out in Phoenix, which took place in a few weeks. But PBDI is looking fantastic, man. PBDI.
That's awesome.
Yeah. He talks about it in our show. When he was hired, it was in really rough shape. And they've been doing all kinds of work on it the last 7-8 years, all kinds of different projects. He drove me around in his cart on the course, and we got to watch some of his crew digging up and fixing some bunkers and part of the projects that they're overhauling. They're almost finished overhauling all the bunkers on the course, but they're prepping. They're hosting the U.S. Open local qualifier this spring for the second time. And one thing that I didn't, here's an exclusive that I didn't mention in that podcast and haven't mentioned on Instagram.
Yes,
they're flipping their nines. They haven't announced it yet, but he said it's happening because they got these new big bouldered T markers that he was showing me over in the superintendent's area. But they're getting ready to flip the nines for a couple different reasons. One being holes 3, 4, and 5 out there are really blind off the tee shots, and so it tends to back up play a little bit right at the start, and so. That you won't have that issue going into starting on the back nine, and where you go get food and drink at the turn is kind of wonky, and so it requires this like long drive back to number 10. So they're getting ready to flip the nines, and so 10 will be one will be 10. I think cool. In the next couple months, but certainly before the U.S. Open qualifier. Anyway, that was long-winded, but anybody that hasn't checked it out, go check out the Beltway Golfer podcast, episode 79 with Chris Navin out of PBDI Golf Club. That's the plug for there. We'll get to our conversation now.
I love it. Wait, hold on. Before we move on, any sure. Other big takeaways from that convo? It's pretty big conversation and pretty big time for that course.
Yeah, I mean, they're just doing really well. I mean, there's some fun little nuggets out of there, just some of the projects they're doing. Their 8th straight year in revenue growth, which is kind of crazy, which is, I think, in part, he talks about it in part because of all the work they're doing, but also just the state of golf and the industry and how popular and how much it's grown in the last few years. But I love having conversations with superintendents. You know, they know the golf course certainly better than anybody. I think he's only one of the first guys I've ever had on the Beltway Golfer show was Ben Ellis, back when he was the superintendent at Fort Belvoir. He's now back at Andrews Air Force Base. He was great. I had the superintendent at Congressional before the Women's PGA Championship. His name is escaping me right now, but I'll look.
always.
Pete Wendt. I pulled it in time.
Nice.
But I want to have
that
more
the guy from Fall Out Boy?
I don't know. Look, that double fact check me on that. I think it's
yeah.
That's a Wentz, isn't it? One of them.
Maybe.
I think that's. I don't know. Gosh. Anywho, I'm not a Fall Out Boy guy. I'm a generation above that. Fallout
Boy. That was my crew. Yeah.
I'm being honest. I kind of loathed Fallout Boy. Anyway, I want to have more superintendent songs. They're awesome conversations, and every time I have them, I learn more about grass and soil and what it takes to properly maintain a golf course. But there's a lot of interesting things going on at PBDI. They're going for bigger events. You know, he mentioned a couple things to me that I don't think I'm allowed to repeat about just, you know, some of the things they're trying to do there, but I'll just leave it at that. It's exciting times up in Ijamsville. I still know how to pronounce that, the town.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. I was looking at their website. Is it Yams?
It might be. I don't know. I truly don't. Yamsville? I should have asked somebody. I'm going to keep calling it
Either that or it's Ijam. Just got to get it and really enunciate each part.
I can't imagine that's how you pronounce it, but that's how I'm going to keep saying it.
Definitely not. Yeah. That's great. Well, what a cool show. Head over to Beltway Golfer, listen to that pod, available on all platforms and YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's get into night golf. So I know you had a fun round of night golf recently, which we'll get into in a minute. But first, before you do that, the match was last night of us recording this. What was your takeaway from that, watching it?
It was great. You know, I think that those one, just that they do it is a great thing. You can, as you're watching, it feels like it's like 50% cringe and 50% awesome. And like, there's a little bit of like balance there. And I think that, you know, for me, I enjoyed the banter. I enjoyed getting to see some of the personalities of like Rose Zhang and Lexi Thompson and you know, I don't know them as much. I know their names, but getting to see their personalities a little bit more was very fun. Max is hilarious as always. And Rory, you know, just was Rory in there. So, you know, I enjoyed it. I think there's, you know, some cringe that they could clean up over the, you know, years of them doing this. But at this point, the cringe is part of the history as well.
Some of the DJ Khaled stuff, maybe.
Yeah. But I mean, look, if I beat Charles, I would be shouting it from the rooftops every time I had an opportunity. But it was great, man. What did you think?
I thought it was cool. I didn't pay super close attention, but I had it on. I thought it was long.
Yeah.
I do enjoy these exhibitions. I don't think you need to show the, you know, I guess it was 12 hours or 12 holes. The broadcast was maybe 2.5 hours. Feels like I actually saw, I think it was a tweet from Dan Rappaport said, does this need to be live? Like, could they edit this and turn it into an hour and a half show? I think that makes sense. You know,
it's a good point.
When it's just four people out there, all of the stuff in between shots, you know, you want some of that, you know, you want some of the banter, yeah. Some of the jokes. I mean, those are good, but there was a lot of dead time and it got a little bit boring. You know, the course looked awesome. The what's interesting, the night golf, because I think what we're about to get into is how much, you know, we are pro night golf as we start talking about it. However, I will say, I'm not sure how great night golf looks on TV. Like, yeah, it's cool to promote the concept of night golf, and that's why I thought it was awesome. You know, do you want to see night golf on TV all the time? I don't know. The other, I'm also excited just from a personal note. I got my 8-year-old son to watch it with me for the first half. Cool. We're headed down to West Palm Beach. In a few weeks, the first for his spring break, we're going to Washington National spring training, and we're gonna play. I know they've got a 9-hole, so they're playing the full golf course last night, but they've also got like a little 9-hole short course there that's lighted.
Cool.
And so I know we're going to at least play that. I might play the full course, but I'm going to play the 9-hole lighted course with my son. So we're pumped about that when we're down there. So I'll report back on that in a few weeks. But what I was going to say, there was another one. Did you catch any of this? Was, I don't know, a few weeks ago, the popular YouTube golfers, Good. They had their kind of influencer tournament out at Grass Clippings in Tempe, Arizona, which was during the Waste Management Open, which was also filmed at, you know, it was filmed at night. And so it was one of these exhibitions. I think it was, they had a cold night for that. Did you watch any of that one?
I've seen clips. I didn't watch the whole thing. I saw about it. It's like you said, it's very cool. It's unique. I think the timing of it is nice. Like, you know, usually I think we watch golf during the day. So like having that night golf is fun to watch when you're, you know, settling down, having a drink, whatever you're doing at the end of the night. It is tough to see. I mean, there were a number of times last night when we were watching it that, you know, Max or somebody hit balls into the crowd. They didn't even know. They didn't even know where the ball was. So, you know, it's a little tough to do those kinds of things. But right. I mean, if you don't care, then I'm all for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The good one was also, I mean, I watched the first half. They did like half of it on YouTube Live. And then the second half, at some point they switched over to Peacock, which is where I didn't follow them into that. But I watched it for half an hour, 40 minutes. And it was the same kind of thing. It was interesting. It was, you know, they had a decent amount of people out there watching it live. And it was just kind of interesting to see a totally different type of production. But again, I love night golf, and we're going to start talking about all the reasons we love night golf. But on TV, I don't know if it's again great to promote it, and I'm all for it. I'm not sure how it plays super well on TV. But
I wonder if they would, you know, I know the pros want to play with their ball and stuff like that. But like, give me like a light up ball or something. Like, give me something that helps me track what we're doing a little bit more. And like, I think that solves it. It's very hard to see a white ball in the sky when you got all these lights and glare and things like that. If we were shooting neon green, you know, glow in the dark balls, it might be a little bit more interesting, although it takes away from the competitive integrity a little bit.
So you played a round down in North Carolina. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was so fun. It was at this place, Knights Play, in Apex, North Carolina. What was amazing, I got the scorecard over here. I'm going to pull it out. What was really cool about it was, so there's three 9-hole par threes that wrap around this amazing driving range. And all three of the par three courses are under the lights. So, you know, not only is this a place that's accessible, but you're there, you know, you could play till 10, 11 PM. Like, you know, usually the last tee times are, you know, a lot of times 3, 4 PM. And here, you know, you can just go. It was so cool. So one, really enjoyed the layout. And I think 9-hole par threes under the lights makes sense because you don't have to light as much space. You know, it's more compact, and you can have lights, you know, strategically covering specific areas or multiple greens and things like that. And just the way that some of those other courses and you know, specifically the, you know, par three courses are pretty condensed, I think it benefits that a little bit more. So that was really cool. The range was slam packed. There were people in every single bay, and then there were people standing behind the bay. There were families, there were people on dates, there were groups of friends. I have never seen a range around the DMV that looked like this. It made me smile. It was like, this is what I want. This is what I feel like we need in this area. It was social. It was fun. And it was slam packed.
Interesting. Wow. Was there, what about it you think made it so slam? You they have top tracer?
Maybe. I don't think so. I think it's, really? You know, one, it was 15 degrees warmer than here. So people are ready to get outside. So, you know, it was beautiful 65 degree, you know, day, night. We're in North Carolina. I don't know. Like, I feel like something like that could be equally as successful here. I do think that there are, you know, limitations to some of this stuff. And I want to get into some of the economics behind it, because I listened to this awesome podcast about it, and there's some good points that they made. But, you know, it felt like a different energy and more of a community place than some of our public courses here. And I don't know why, but it had that vibe.
I'm the way I'm picturing it, and I'm familiar with Knights Golf Center, but I've never been there. I've researched it a little bit when planning golf trips down the area, but I've never been. But when I think about ranges around the DC area, especially at public courses, they're not really designed for like a social atmosphere. You know, I think, you know, obviously probably the busiest one being down at East Potomac, which these days it's hard to find a bay. But, you know, there's, you know, you're kind of in an enclosed space. Maybe two people can fit in each one, you know, but most courses, it's just, you know, the hitting area. And then there's either a wall right behind you or something else, but they're not designed with like a social environment tied in where people could be hanging out. And even when you think about Top Golf and some of the others, like, you know, we go to the Rudy's here in Alexandria, which is a former Top Golf space. There's still not a ton of room. I mean, there's it's designed, there's maybe a table, there's space for two or three people, but it almost feels too, I don't know, corporately.
So what do you do then? Like if you're designing a range, like what kind of elements are you thinking about to make it more social?
I'm not saying, you know, obviously East Potomac is going to get totally blown up here eventually. And I think their plans are to move the range over closer towards Main Avenue there, but, or that's not Main Avenue. What is that? Ohio Drive. But if you picture, just as an example, if you picture East Potomac's driving range, you knock down all the walls behind the hitter. You know, this isn't going to happen, and they're not going to do this. But I'm just saying, if you wanted to turn that as an example into a social environment, move the greens back 10 feet, and those all be kind the space then between the hitting bays and where those putting greens are. You know, there's tables. Maybe the food truck is over there, and cool. It's just because that becomes a whole hangout space. There's music playing, and there's undefined space where people are just hanging out, and in front of them people are hitting. Then you kind of create that area where it's, you know, it's more of a social environment with people hitting balls, you know, as a part of it.
That's interesting. But
yeah, there's not really anything like that around here.
It's like you have to. I think right now we think of people as the golfer, and we want to give them the golf experience. Like here, you come and you could play, and this is your bay, and it's pretty secluded. And the other one is kind of treating it more as a social experience where you golf. And I think that if people design things with a little bit more of that in mind, you'd probably have the bar a little bit closer. You know, you'd probably have a little bit more of that social gathering area, like you said, that open space table, something to encourage people to hang out and be a part of that area, maybe when they're not hitting balls.
So was the golf course itself, was it packed or was it busy?
Dude, slam packed. It was great. It was so great. It was, you know, we played probably maybe 6 to 9 p.m. So it was cool because we got to actually transition, you know, watch the sun go down, transition to the lights, really, really beautiful sunset going down over everything. And you know, it was interesting to see everything shift and a whole new crowd came in, kind of like less kids, you know, some more teenagers and things like that came in as it got a little darker, you know. And the other thing is you're making money, man. Like this course was slam packed for another couple hours that otherwise they wouldn't. So, you know, as those days get longer, you can make a fair amount of money by keeping your course open a little bit longer. The course was in good shape, even for as much as, you know, there was a lot of throughput on it, but the course was in good shape. It was interesting shots. I think, you know, we'll talk about the Belmont, the other little par three that I went to the other day, but like, this was a little bit more of the, you know, anybody can play par three. There's certain par threes that are, you know, high end with, you know, very nice bunkers and fast greens. And then there's other things that are a little bit more muni style. And this, I would say, is a little bit more on that side. The one knock, honestly, I'd have to say on night golf is the lights buzz. There is a buzzing that occurs. And I don't know if that's just something we haven't like figured out how to like work around, but it is distinct. You know, it is a large humming buzz that occurs as you get closer to these things. And I think, you know, as you play, you kind of don't think about it, but you know, the noise pollution there as you're trying to like, you know, have around, some people may not like that, but that would be probably my only knock on it, that, you know, other than maybe environmental issues that people have about electricity and whatever that I'm not going to touch. But the buzzing was definitely something that after a while I was like, yeah, that's a little old.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that. I wonder if that issue's been resolved. I'd be curious if the folks at Grass Clippings in Arizona or at the Palm are experiencing that. That's hadn't thought about that.
It was interesting. Or like, how do you make it so they're solar powered and a little bit more economical? Like I feel like there's some interesting things, but you posed this question on Twitter and I want to push back to you, which I think is great, is, you know, where in this area should we toss lights? I think that, like, you know, looking around, I think East Potomac would be an interesting one because it's pretty compact and the light pollution from DC wouldn't be devastating compared to certain communities and things like that. But any more thoughts since your tweet last night?
Yeah, in my tweet last night, I threw out the first two that came to mind that are truly, like, I think totally secluded, where you're not going to, there's not a residential home that's going to complain at all, or Henson Creek over in PG County and Pohick Bay, part of the NVRPA, which is part of a larger park. I can't think of what it is. I think it is part of Pohick Bay Regional Park. And I'm sure there's a few others, but you're right. You know, something closer to town would work better. And East Potomac's probably the one. You know, East Potomac, in other news, National Links Trust just kind of announced to the DC council that they put a number on their whole renovation, and they're seeking some bonds that I think, you know, in to the tune of like $80 million. So adding additional cost to their project is not a likelihood. They probably certainly wouldn't do that on the blue course. But, you know, again, if we're playing kind of fantasy land here a little bit, and who knows as their project develops, their plans for where the white course is going to go, especially since if there is any light pollution from a golf course that would impact residents, down at East Potomac, you're only thinking about the Southwest Wharf, the Southwest Waterfront, and some of the condos over there. Well, the new positioning of where they're going to move the range, at least according to their existing plans for the future of what East Potomac looks like, the range essentially would block that. Now, you know, you're also thinking that there's probably going to be lights at the range, but, you know, again, following this line of thinking,
sure,
the white course is then kind of hidden behind the range where it is now, where I think the white course will be in part where the white course exists, and then also take up a good portion of where the driving range is now. So all of that will essentially be on the south end of Haynes Point, and so you wouldn't really be bothering anyone. So this is another long-winded way of me saying, I think lights on the future white course could be the answer here.
I love that. I'm about to go play the white course after this. So I'm going to go do a little site check for you. And
I think that'd be awesome. I mean, you get people coming across the 14th Street Bridge. They look down, see, it'd be incredible. It'd be incredible.
And if anybody's got a couple mills laying around and they want to light up the white course for us, please do so.
I'm sure there are other examples. You know, the ones I was running through my head are either too remote, like a Poolsville, which is now Crossvines. Like, okay, they could probably put up lights there, but it's almost like so out of the way. Would you
massive
get much,
too?
Would you get that much business way out that way at night? I don't know, but a lot of them, there's like three sides of the course could work, but there's always one side, like you suggested, Sligo Creek, which they could probably pull it off, but there's one side of the course with a bunch of homes facing, so that might be a hurdle. There's not a ton of courses that are truly like surrounded by trees. Algonquian might be one, because that's part of a larger regional park. There's no homes out there. They could pull it off. But what's interesting about this, we can get to the Golfers Journal podcast that you listen to. I'm sure there's some interesting nuggets in the podcast with Jared Dorfler, I think it was. I have not listened to the podcast, but I subscribe to his newsletter. His newsletter is called The Perfect Putt. So I imagine some of the things that you heard are some of the things that I actually pulled out of his newsletter. And there's a couple of interesting stats, but I'll let you go ahead. Why don't you tell folks about what you heard on the pod?
Yeah, you know, highly recommend it. It was Golfers Journal Pod 156, the Golf Earnings Report. And they talk a lot about, they talk about Sim Golf. So plug, check out the Beltway Golfers. What is it? You have an indoor Sim map of the area. So if you're interested in doing that, check out the website, check out all the places in the DMV. You can go play sim golf. But they talk about the economics behind sim golf, the economics behind, you know, some of these lit par threes and some of this stuff. And he made some really good points. I think that it was a very interesting listen. And I think anybody who's interested in the business of golf and kind of where things are going, you know, in the first podcast, I was shouting it. I think we need more short golf. We need more six hole golf. We need more golf that gets, you know, that's in between driving ranges or top golf and full length courses. And they kind of talk about that. They talk about sim golf and the explosion. They talk about these lit par threes and how, you know, it may not work in certain areas. Like, for example, a night golf in Florida and or any par three in Florida is going to be able to do better than a course in Massachusetts or even in Maryland, because they don't have to deal with winter the way that we do. I mean, you got to toss on a sweatshirt, but you could still play, you know, all hours of the day. You could still play at night, but it's interesting.
Well, I would say, first of all, you could make that argument just without night golf that, you know, Florida has 12 months of play where Massachusetts and Maryland do it. But I will say, but here's my pushback on that. Look at the weather right now in Maryland. I mean, we're in
global
February.
Global warming has helped us.
But we're in February. The weather's fantastic and it's still getting dark early. The other day, this is about a week or two ago, it wasn't super warm, but it was my son and I wanted, you know, it was a weeknight. We wanted to go hit the range. We drove down to East Potomac. It was like 7 p.m. It was pitch blackout, but it was 7 p.m. And I didn't even look to see it was open. I kind of just assumed it was open. And we get down there and there was one car in the parking lot and the place is totally shut down. And again, I didn't look at the hours. So shame on me. But the one guy in the parking lot is one of the employees is coming out. And I kind of asked him, I was like, is the place shut down? And he said, well, if you can see, go ahead. And so we did. We went out and putted for a little while. And I'm sure the management there probably, if they're listening, probably won't love to hear this. But we played a golf hole and went out and smacked a couple balls around. And it was great. My point being, you could add a couple hours here, especially in those shoulder months where it's still dark. And
totally.
Daylight savings isn't hit.
Totally. That's my point. No, you're right. And I think, you know, this area has gotten warmer over the years. But, you know, we still have 3-4 months where it's less than ideal compared to somewhere warmer climate where you can just rake in cash for 12 months. Yeah. That was some of the you know, bits on this pod, and definitely give it a listen, because they go into all of this stuff deeper. But, you know, what he really identified, and you know, again, I've been saying it and I think other people are identifying it, is that there's a huge opportunity here to bring night golf and shorter golf into the ecosystem in a larger way. And we're seeing it happen. I would love to know the economics behind nights play and how, you know, how much it costs to keep things open and what those lights cost to, you know, put in and keep running and the maintenance and does what you're generating counteract the investment that you need to make? Like, I don't know.
Well,
but it seems so, pretty good.
So the same guy, again, I might be butchering how you pronounce his name, but Jared Dorfler, I believe.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Who is the guest on the Golfers Journal podcast that you listened to. Again, I haven't listened to it, but I've been a subscriber to his newsletter for some time. He puts out, it's a weekly newsletter. Every Monday he sends out a little newsletter of the business of golf. I encourage everybody to sign up for it. But so he did one on night golf, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, which I'm guessing is why Golfers Journal reached out to him, and partly they were talking a lot about night golf. But there's a couple interesting statistics in this newsletter. I printed it up for our conversation. One of them kind of gets to your question you just asked. But first, well, I'll start with that. So he talks to the folks at Grass Clippings. So Grass Clippings, again, is the group that took over the golf course in Tempe and hosted the Good tournament. And I think they're starting their own. I just saw some announcement. I don't know all the details, but they're starting their own night golf league called the Grass League. I don't know if that's going to be televised. I don't know if that's more than just a local thing. I got to do some more research on that. But anyway, he has some statistics from Grass Clippings and the installation. Keep in mind, that's 18 hole par three golf course, 78 lights. The lights alone were $1.2 million. Labor and materials to put up the lights were another $1 million. So $2.2 million to essentially install lights for an 18-hole par three course. But you start doing the back of the napkin math. And, you know, let's say I started to do this for the white course. Again, this was very, very rudimentary. Very rudimentary.
Yes.
But
look, if we get lights on the white course one day, it's going to be because of this conversation. So this is very important.
So I did this in like 30 seconds. So don't jump down my throat if these numbers are way off. But I feel like this is a little bit conservative. So $30 per play. Let's say I lost my math. Let's say you get $30 a round. You get an extra, on average, 3 hours of tee times. You know, that number might be high because in the summer it doesn't get dark. It doesn't get dark until like, I don't even know, like 8 o'clock around here. And so are people teeing off at 11 p.m.? Probably not.
I mean, I bet they would.
So let's even, you know what, let's drop that down to like an extra 2 hours of tee times, right? So going off every 10 minutes, that's 24 golfers per hour. That's 48 golfers in that 2 hour period, assuming you're doing well. Let's say you do that 200 nights a year. So that's a little over 6 months, almost 7 months. So not, you know, you're getting rid of winter, but you've, again, maybe that's optimistic. I don't know. This is quick math, but you're with that math. One second. I've lost my math here. Do the math for me. So that's 40. What's 48 times 30? That's
pulling 13, out the calculator.
That's 1,300 additionally a day. Right?
1,440.
Okay. 1,400 times that
1,400.
Okay. Multiply that by 200 days a year.
That's $288,000.
All right. $288,000. So if those numbers make sense or if they're close, I don't know if they're conservative or aggressive. I don't know.
Okay.
They feel like they're in the ballpark.
Yeah.
And it costs $2.2 million to install for an 18-hole golf course. Let's call it 1.5 for a nine-hole golf course.
Sure.
You're getting your money back in 5-6 years. And now there's probably other costs,
no, and I think that, you know, those people also, I would argue, and I don't know if this is true because people like to drink during the day too, but night golf, probably a couple more people are spending money at the clubhouse, getting dinner, drinking, sure. You know, yeah. Doing some of those other things. You know, I imagine that some of those hours, like you said, like if people are willing to play and people are, you know, you could probably extend that. There's no reason to shut it down at 11 o'clock if you still have people wanting to do those tee times. So it's very interesting. And I think you're right. Like the economics are there for it. And then if you add in some of those other things, you make it more of a social experience. You know, hopefully people stay in booze and you know, that's really where I think the money can really start to explode.
For sure. The other really interesting stat from his newsletter on night golf, you know, with simulator golf, there's a long quote around indoor simulator golf, how there's more simulators businesses in South Korea than Starbucks or coffee stores. There's one on every corner in Seoul. Lighted golf courses, though, in South Korea, there is a total of 514 golf courses. 117 of them, or 20% of them, offer night golf with lights. 20% wow. of the golf courses. It's kind of crazy. In the United States, there's 16,000 golf courses. You know how many golf courses in the United States have lighted or offer night golf lighted? 60.
50. Oh, wow.
You're close. 60.
Yeah.
So less than 1%. So crazy. Is there ever going to be 20%? No, of course not. But there's huge room for growth. And it is interesting, you know, how much will these kind of televised events like the one last night, the match, like the good one at Grass Clippings and any future ones that they have out of there, will kind of change the mindset and kind of open the mind of what the possibilities are for some of these golf course operators. Because, you know, it's interesting. In all my podcasts that I've done around here with Beltway Golfer, the only one I can remember it coming up was in late 2022. I sat down with, and I think I mentioned his name in our first Surrender Birdies, the director of golf for Fairfax County, Ryan Carman. Right at the end of the podcast, I asked him because he was talking about, you know, the possibility of a future 9-hole course at Laurel Hill, and we were kind of running through all their different properties, including some of their existing par 3 courses. And I asked him about night golf, And, you know, I'd be curious, you know, Ryan's my guy. I'd be curious if his attitude's changed about it at all in the last year and a half, because his response was, I was a little surprised. He was not a fan. He brought up
interesting
things like employees working late and, you know, other things that you have to think about, like some of the risks associated with it. But he was generally, you know, it was a short part of the conversation. I'll put it that way. But I'd be curious if I asked Ryan today if he changed his mind about that at all.
We should definitely check in. And I think it'll be interesting to see if people, you know, I think it was also, if you ask people 5 years ago, it was just too expensive or not worth it, or, you know, sometimes things change. And, you know, maybe 5-10 years ago, this area, we were getting more winter. It was colder. Like now, maybe this area is a little bit more open to it because of the economics of, you know, hey, it's warmer here. We can get more people playing. You know, the Korea analogy is really interesting, and they touch on it in the podcast too. And he was saying, he was like, don't look at Korea and say, oh, because it can work there, it can work here. These are completely different ecosystems. Like Korea is essentially run out of land to build golf courses on. So right. They need to, that's why sim is so big. That's why night golf is so big, because, you know, getting a tee time is really hard. We don't have the same issues. We have different issues, but I think that the main thing is that what you're talking about is that the economics potentially are there for places to do it. And with the right places that build that ecosystem, because if Knights Play is not crushing it, then they're doing something wrong, because they were slam packed. And if that's the case, and that's how they are throughout the summer, I imagine that we're going to see more of it based on the success that they and Grass Clippings and some of those other places are having. I personally would love to see it around here. Like we don't have a place, man. Like it's I would love to go play more night golf. I think it's a fun experience. I think that, you know, different people, you know, might be more encouraged to go and play and have that experience. And in the summer, when it's a million degrees outside, I mean, I've gone and played, you know, courses at 1 p.m. or 12 p.m. because that's when I could get a tee time, where I was miserable. It was absolutely miserable. And if my option was 12 p.m. or 8 p.m., personally, I'd be more inclined to do that 8 p.m. I know other people can't do it. They have kids, they got whatever. But like, you know, I feel as though those options would be exciting to certain groups of people.
Sure. Well, fingers crossed that, you know, the wheels start turning around this area.
You got to ask if anybody's listening and you have a place, if you think there's a great place to, you know, put up lights, hit up Beltway Golfer and let us know, you know, where you're thinking.
So here's a place that, you know, could put lights in, although I know they've got some new condos kind of overlooking the course, but your alma mater, which is right up the street actually from where I grew up. But the only time I've ever been on the golf course was for a high school track meet, which is Georgetown Prep. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Georgetown Prep and their golf course?
Yeah, this was one of the other adventures that I went on. You know, I went to school there, spent 4 years there, and never stepped foot on the golf course. It was, at the time, we had a full 18 hole, I believe, course. And then they took half of it and built condos, and then they reworked this nine. And it was such a joy, man. Like one of the things that I was blown away at is, you know, it's very hilly, and in this small area, you have all of these different shots.
It's not still nine holes, is it? I thought it was even less than that. I thought it was like five or seven or something.
So I think it's seven or nine, but you're doing a lot of crisscrossing and okay, you know, using some of the same tee boxes and things like that. I'll send you the course map, but it was really cool. It was, you know, one, I felt like it is a perfect course for a high school because it really did. It gives you a lot of different shots. You're pulling out driver. You've got, you know, elevation change. You've got shooting up, shooting down, shooting left, shooting right. you know, you've got all of the different shots that you would need to go out into the larger golfing world. So for as a high school and you know, building something for kids to practice on to then send them out in the world, I thought it was awesome. It felt very emblematic of prep in that regard, which I thought was cool. The prep campus is beautiful. But if you click that link where it says Georgetown Prep's nine on there, you'll see the little course map. So you can see how it kind of like goes back and forth. But one of the things that I really enjoyed doing also was like I dove into some of the history of the course. So, you know, I've really enjoyed kind of diving into golf history and learning and all these different things. And I reached out to one of my professors at prep who is kind of like the prep historian. And he sent me all of this information. It was really, really cool. So, you know, when they first put the course together, it's 1920. So this course has been around for almost 100 years and it's changed over the years, but has had a lot of different influence on it. And it's also had a lot of impact, and the people have had a lot of impact on golf nationally, which I thought was really cool. So little cool thing about the grass, the seed. I'm reading from The Blue and the Gray, Volume 4, 1926. It said, "The finest seed possible was obtained from Germany for the greens, and a mixture of Kentucky blue and red top was used for the fairways. The South German creeping bent used for the greens was recommended by Dr. Oakley of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who's recognized throughout the country as the leading authority on golf turf." So like these guys were like, you know, building something really, really cool and really special at the time. The other thing that I thought was cool is kind of who was involved. Does the name Frank Emmett ring a bell to you? Sure. So, you know, here's a guy who was deeply involved in prep, deeply involved in the prep scene and all of that kind of formation of it. But also he was huge in youth golf. You know, like he has this quote, he said, "I want Georgetown Prep to be the cradle of junior golf in America." And I read his obituary and it said that, you know, a lot of what he built and organized at prep was a model that was used for youth golf in the nation, throughout the nation. So it's just so cool. One, you know, the history, the care, you know, what was put into designing this course. And then, you know, the history and effort of Mr. Emmett and Frank and how he, you know, built that ecosystem at prep, but then that influence had a massive influence on junior golf throughout the country. That was just so cool to learn. I had no idea that this history was just sitting, you know, right here 15 minutes away from me.
I love that. I didn't know most of that. And I literally grew up almost walking. I did grow up walking distance to Georgetown Prep, although I did not go there and really only spent time there sneaking into their basketball gyms during high school for some late night hoop runs. But this is the first time I've seen this map. I'm going to share this out. This is a nice find. So yeah, I'm looking at the course map today. It looks like there's seven greens, but they have a nine-hole routing where, yeah, there's a mixture of repeating tee boxes and repeating greens. But I don't know. It looks cool. I got to dig into this more. But
it's really cool. We got to go play it at some point. You'll have a blast. Yeah. It's hard to picture, too, because the topography changes. Like, as you're looking at this fairway where you see one and kind of seven crisscross, is maybe 150 feet above this lake that where number four is.
Yeah, like that I remember. The track meet that I referenced in high school, I did cross country in high school. This is back in the 90s. And I think Georgetown Prep's got a pretty, that for a long, long time, they've hosted a big cross country meet called the Georgetown Prep Invitational. I think that's what it's called, but I competed in that. So I remember those hills because you ran through the golf course. But no, this is interesting. Yeah, no, I'm gonna take you up on that invite to go play that. This is cool. I'm gonna share this out.
Really cool. And then the last piece of info that I thought was pretty cool is then, you know, they got redesigned, and Joseph Hills, the son of Arthur Hills, is who kind of redid it. And Joseph has an architect firm that is still working. But you know, Arthur Hills, you know, for those of you who don't know, was incredibly prolific in the area and nationally, over 200 courses, including Blue Mash, Manor Country Club, Maryland National, Lynx at Lighthouse Sound, Woodmont Country Club, and Bell Haven. And so, you know, this wasn't Arthur, but it was his boy. And and I think he did a great job of building up this kind of new nine that they have. And like I said, you know, it really is a great test for a young golfer. It gives you all the shots that you need to go out into that broader golfing world.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. The Georgetown Prep course has come up on my podcast a couple times because Georgetown Prep's got a hell of a golf program. I've had a couple guys, including, you know, Denny McCarthy, who everybody knows, was on the show, but also Davis Lamb was an All-Met Player of the Year from Georgetown Prep, who's on the Korn Ferry Tour right now. And episode 71 of the Beltway Golfer podcast, Justin Nogay, who's the Stone Ridge golf coach, also played at Georgetown Prep. So I've had three different prep golfers, and I think the golf course has come up in the conversation in one form or another in each of those podcasts. But I'm sure it helps a golf program having a place that I know that they didn't treat it as their home course, but more of a practice course. But it's got to help your game, being able to walk outside and practice.
Oh yeah. I mean, I got to show you this too. I gotta show you this picture right here. So this is the prep golf team, 1924. Look at these guys.
That's cool.
Just the style is great, you know?
Yeah.
Look at these guys and the socks.
Some of the sweaters are hilarious. Love it.
Yep. I mean, I feel like we got to do a little retro day. Maybe go out in some baggy pants and high socks one day. I think that'd be a blast.
Sure.
But yeah, thank you for allowing me to dive into that. It was just really cool. I've loved, you know, as I've done this and as I'm doing research for the pod, I'm just looking around and what is out there and what can I learn, and I think that there's so much golf history and a lot of this stuff, you know, is right there. There's, you know, Prep luckily has wonderful historians who really care for the history, but you know, there's so much history in this area in both like the competitive scene, but also the courses themselves and who was involved and the choices that they made and some of the reasons behind some of the choices that they made. It's just fascinating. The other course I got to play was, I got to go over to the Belmont golf course outside of Richmond, which was really cool on my way back from Carolina. I didn't play the full thing, just played the Little Bell, which was a little six, kind of like walked through it. But the history of that course is incredible as well. You know, I was reading about, they had, let me try to find it. I had my golf notes here. That's, I think, Sam Snead played there. Ben Hogan. Yeah, Sam Snead, 1949 PGA Championships. Ben Hogan, 1945 Richmond Invitational. So. Yeah. I mean, it's so cool that these guys, you know, walk in the same links that I am just a couple hundred years later.
Sure. That's a course I've played that. I did, again, a lot of these conversations, intentionally or unintentionally, are become plugs for podcast episodes. But episode 27 of the Beltway Golfer podcast, I sat down with the head of First Tee Richmond, Virginia, Brent Schneider, who the First Tee is kind of operates Belmont now, both the full 12, the range, and the Little Bell, but got to play it. But that Little Bell course, that's absolutely a course they could probably pull off lights, because it's kind of secluded on kind of the inner portion of the golf course, and you could put lights on that without offending any local homeowners, I would think. I don't know. I wonder if they. But that's a super cool property.
Yeah. And that was a challenging course too, you know, as you talk about the par three, like not all par threes have to be, I think a lot of people like laugh at par threes and they don't take them seriously. That was a serious par three. Greens were fast and taken serious, a lot of elevation. So if you missed the green, you were having to do some kind of chip out of, you know, sand, you know, with a 5-6 foot lip. There was a lot of challenge built into that. And I think, you know, sometimes people don't give those par threes the respect that they deserve, but I very quickly respected that course. One was a nice ease in, and then two was like, oh hey, you gotta make some golf shots now.
Davis Love and his team did an awesome job on that course. so we're going to wrap it up here, but I know there's one of the things last week we talked about. It wasn't our last episode. It might've been after we stopped recording. So I don't know if it was on the podcast or not, but we were talking about a golf course. I don't know if you played it or not, but you're planning to play out in West Virginia. But the conversation, what we're going to verify here is the pronunciation. I have a lot of golf courses that we already learned with iJamsville that I probably mispronounce. But I, the course that the way I pronounce it has always been Kekapin and Kekapin Resorts, an old RTJ course. So here's the question for you, because you're going to go verify it, because I think you either went out there or you go out there a lot. Did you verify the pronunciation, and am I pronouncing it right or wrong?
So I did go out there. I didn't get to play. It actually snowed that day that I was out there in West Virginia, but it is actually Kekapin. 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 And beautiful course, beautiful place. I think that West Virginia and West Virginia golf is another underrated, world and ecosystem. And, that course is super fun. It's really interesting. It's large. There's some cool, interesting shared greens and some cool elevation change. Like as you kind of go about the course, it really is a fun challenge. And if you can time it up with when the leaves change and kind of like mid to late October, it's one of the most beautiful courses out there, man.
Yeah, I've played it a handful of times and for years, and it's I enjoy that course a lot, and I will pronounce it Kekapin from now on. So shame
Kekapin.
On me. Kekapin. Sorry, what was that?
Kekapin.
Did I just say how I already pronounced it? Kekapin. Yeah. All right, Kekapin. I'll get that in my head.
There's a lot of great courses out there.
While we're on the topic, another one that I mispronounced for a long, long time after playing it several times, maybe I just got to talk to more people. Mattapani Springs in Virginia for quite a long time, which is, almost down to in Reuther Glen, I believe, east of 95, almost to Richmond. Another kind of beautiful rolling mountain course. And that's not really a mountain course, but there's some elevation change. But for the longest time, I called it Mattapony Springs, which is absolutely not how you pronounce it.
This is the one that I struggled with for a while was Piankatank. Piankatank. Yeah, great spot. Great spot right outside of Richmond.
All right, we'll wrap it up. A couple things. Just it sounds like we've been chatting, and outside of golf, we got basketball's heating up. I think we're going to do a Beltway Golfer March Madness bracket. Stay tuned for that in the next few weeks. I've been running March Madness brackets for literally decades, and I think this is the year to open it up to the larger Beltway Golfer group and Surrender Birdies listeners. I think we're going to. I'm digging back into the. I'm going to redo the whole pro shop and kind of merch. The Beltway Golfer website is not great, but working on redoing it. But we're going to get some new Surrender Birdies gear already in the works. Yes. In the meantime, there is the hoodie tee is still available on the website. I don't think there's every size. There's at least a few sizes. So if you're listening to this and you need some Surrender Birdies gear. It's a great logo, in front of the Mormon temple with the overpass. Go to beltwaygolfer.com and there's a few Surrender Birdie hoodie tees left there. Check it out. But
that was the first piece of Beltway Golfer gear that I got, which was pretty cool.
Love it.
Can I put in a request too? Can we get Please. Some crew neck stuff?
Sure.
I'm a big crew neck guy. Okay. I don't wear hoods anymore. I don't know what it is.
Really? Okay.
I grew up, I feel like I'm now a crew neck. I'm a crew neck guy.
My issue with crew neck, honestly, well, this is really just talking sweaters, is the girth of my belly, quite frankly. And I feel like hoodies hide it a little bit better. Anyway, we'll wrap it up there.
It's very important. All
right. Very appreciate important. It, Josh. We'll talk again in a couple weeks.
All right, Alex. Thanks so much, man.